4:59 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor and broadcast live from the 2014 Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. The 27th annual festival will take place July 3rd through the 6th, 2014, at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. It will feature Greg Allman, Los Lobos, Lee Fields, and The Expressions among the 100-plus acts that will perform over the four-day festival. The 27th annual Waterfront Blues Festival will benefit the Oregon Food Bank. More information on artists, tickets, and the KBOO broadcast of the festival can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle Productions presentation of OMG, It's the Donnie Show. For 3 weeks only, Donnie Horn will host a new variety show in the style of Laugh-In and The Ed Sullivan Show. OMG, It's the Donnie Show premieres on June 13th, with shows on Fridays and Saturdays only. They start at 7:30 p.m. at The Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information about this event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, unrest in Brazil as the World Cup soccer tournament begins.
A new bicycle tour gives riders a history of gentrification in Portland.
And President Obama considers action in Iraq.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 13th, 2014. I'm Theo Burke.
And I'm Liam Delta. Over 100 bicyclists gathered in southeast Portland last Monday to take part in the first ever Tour de Gentrification. The tour, one of dozens of rides offered as part of the month-long Pedalpalooza Bicycle Festival, took riders to various sites around the city where development and rising rental prices have forced the dislocation of lower-income tenants, families, and businesses. KBOO's Alexi Horowitz has more.
On a recent Monday afternoon in Colonel Summers Park in southeast Portland, the air was filled with excited chatter and the ringing of bicycle bells. Over 100 bicyclists gathered along the edge of the park's tennis courts, eagerly waiting to get on the road for the first Tour de Gentrification. The tour was one of the dozens of rides and rallies held during the month-long Pedalpalooza Bicycle Festival in June. Organizers promised to bring riders to sites of historical and ongoing gentrification around the city, sites where rapid economic development has led to increased property values and rent prices, and, in many cases, the eviction and dislocation of long-time renters and lower-income families. The event was organized and led by former city council candidate Nicholas Caleb and Portland bicycle activist Hart Noaker. Noaker says the tour came out of widespread discontent about how development projects raise property values in the city.
Le Tour de Gentrification kind of came about after a lot of folks were getting more and more frustrated at the rent raising astronomically while they're not getting paid anymore. You know, and of course, the idea is that landowners or property owners, they want to make the most amount of money possible. So they're going to try to get away with whatever they can. If that means kicking somebody out and moving someone else in of a higher class, hence the word gentry, gentrification, then they're going to do that.
On Monday, Caleb Noaker and several other activists led interested riders on a six-mile meandering tour through South and Northeast Portland, including a stopover at the Food Cart Pod at Southeast Hawthorne and 12th. The pod has recently been slated for eviction following the announcement by the property's owners that it will be the site of a new multi-story apartment complex this coming fall. The tour continued through the Northeast Albina neighborhood and finished at an empty lot that had been slated to become a Trader Joe's until pressure from the Portland African American Leadership Forum led to the company pulling out. Portland has a long history of gentrification and redlining. In the 1960s, the Albina neighborhood, one of the largest African-American neighborhoods in Portland, was forced to relocate in preparation for the construction of the Emmanuel Hospital. The hospital was later relocated, but the neighborhood was forced to move nonetheless. Now, a half century later, many of the area's current inhabitants are lamenting the next wave of development, rising rents, and dislocation. Rachel Hunter, an adjunct professor of French at Portland State University and Portland Community College, was on the group's first tour and shared her story of having recently been forced to move after property values spiked in her neighborhood.
I actually lived in a house sort of sandwiched between Williams Street and Mississippi Street, which was becoming more and more popular and more developed and more homogenous. I lived there. I had three roommates. I'd lived there for about 2 years. And in February, we got an email from our landlord saying she was going to sell the house and that in her perfect world, it would be on the market tomorrow and sell in 30 days.
Hunter says that the tour both highlighted the prevalence of the issue and demonstrated that there was a large community interested in working to address gentrification.
I felt really empowered just knowing that there was a community that I could get involved with and that even if it was going to be a battle of attrition or, you know, if it was a lost cause from the beginning, at least there were people who were willing to fight that fight.
Caleb and Noaker see the ride as a means of coalescing support and beginning a long process of resistance.
My strategy for doing this is that we don't start from the position of saying like, hey, we'd like slightly more affordable housing. We start from the position of demanding a lot. And, you know, then once we open up the communication and they see we're serious and they see we have people on our side who are not just thinking practically but are also very morally angry about what's happened, then this space for discussion opens up and we can start into the details. That's just my strategy, though.
Dozens of riders gathered after the tour to share stories and to discuss possible strategies for direct action on the issue. Nick Caleb says that more than anything, events like La Tour de Gentrification offer an opportunity to bring like-minded people together, to communicate and grow solidarity. It's also, as Hart Noaker points out, a way to make activism a bit more fun and accessible.
I think there's a lot of ways you can use direct action to get to the sort of the goal you want, which is, of course, that people get to stay in their homes, they get to be able to afford to live in the city. We're all sort of contributing to this social commons that makes Portland a great place to live, but if we're all going to get priced out, what kind of place is it anymore? I think people really have a responsibility when they move here to look at the history, find ways to preserve that history, find ways to be part of the community and make a positive impact.
Nicholas Caleb and Hart Noaker, along with their recently formed Portland Right to the City Coalition, have scheduled an open discussion forum at Concordia University on June 22nd to address issues of gentrification, the displacement of lower-income communities and residents, and the increasing cost of living in the Portland metropolitan area. Those interested in attending can find more information on Noaker's website, rebelmetropolis.org, and on the Facebook page of the Portland Right to the City Coalition. For KBOO News, this is Alexi Horowitz.
Workers from the Campaign for Restoration and Regulation of Hemp marched this morning in Portland. This is the second day in a row that the petition gatherers marched on their employer's office and challenged the employer's labor practices. They say that they were not paid for petition signature gathering earlier in June. Their paychecks have bounced in the past. They were supposed to get paid on a Friday. Instead, management compensated them with $5, cigarettes, bagels, and a promise that pay would come the following Monday. Workers were asked to work through the weekend without pay. On Monday, when no checks came, the workers walked out and formed the United Campaign Workers Union. The march traveled today from the Industrial Workers of the World offices to their CHHR campaign headquarters on Sandy Boulevard. KBOO reporter Jamie Partridge was on the scene and brings us this report.
This is Jamie Partridge with KBOO News. I'm at the headquarters of the Industrial Workers of the World with the United Campaign Workers who are on strike for almost a week now for at first unpaid wages, and then they formed a union and have developed a whole series of demands of the Campaign for the Restoration and Regulation of Hemp, which is the ballot measure campaign to legalize marijuana. They believe that the workers deserve basic respect and the right to determine the terms and conditions of their employment.
Do you know what they're telling the new hires about the strike?
Oh, I'm pretty sure they're telling them that there's, you know, a bad union, and I'm we have reason to believe, many of the people who still work there think we all quit and have quit since Tuesday. That is, of course, not the case. We all turned in attention to strike letters, and we have been, signing new back-to-work agreements every single day, but not daily, because this keeps happening.
How possible is it for you guys to talk with the new hires?
Well, like one-on-one? That's we're going to be taking point on today.
We talked to one brand-new hire yesterday, and he was actually on the campaign in 2012, and he thinks management is doing it wrong after being on the job for only a day.
An hour.
Yeah.
He was out there for an hour, and we got to him.
Yep.
That's the ticket.
So when you say you're on scab patrol, you're going out and visiting the places where people are doing the petitioning.
We're saying, hey, we're the union. We're bringing you some water and some extra pens because we want you to do well today. Just to let you know, there's a lot of crazy stuff going around the office. This is who we are. Let's not be weird,
Yeah, we've also talked to petitioners from Democracy Resources and Fieldworks, which are two, for-profit contract canvassing offices that we believe should organize, too.
Yeah, I've been talking to everybody I see on the street with the clipboard. I've been giving everybody I see with the clipboard a flyer and a button to tell them about who we are and what we're doing. And I remember when I went out on Wednesday, I ran out of flyers in about 45 minutes.
Make workers' rights plain. Help us save our campaign.
We're marching down Sandy Boulevard on the way to the headquarters of the campaign for the restoration of hemp, the ballot measure campaign, whose petitioners are on strike, have formed a union, are demanding a greater voice in the campaign.
Get out. You're not. Get out of here.
So the manager has told all these strikers to get out.
That was KABU's Jamie Partridge reporting on a strike by petitioners for marijuana legalization in Oregon.
For the last 3 months, Cambodian Americans around the U.S., and especially in the Seattle area, have been on edge because of the recent dramatic jump in deportation of Khmer American men. These men came to the U.S. as children of refugee families after escaping the genocide in Cambodia. This weekend in Tacoma, Washington, Cambodian Americans are gathering with the group Not One More, which calls for an end to deportations that break families apart. The group calls for immigration reform that gives dignity and respect to every individual facing deportation. They say that judges should be the ones to decide family and community impact, or to decide if family and community impacts mitigate the law's requirement that a person must be deported. The Cambodian Americans and their supporters are gathering at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma tomorrow at noon. This is the site of a recent hunger strike challenging the conditions at the immigration detention facility and the practice of arbitrary deportations. The prison is run by the private prison company known as the GEO Group, which has come under fire for the conditions in many of its prisons across the country. The contract with the GEO Group expires this summer, and activists across the Northwest have called on the government to reconsider the decision to privatize the immigration prison in Tacoma. The Cambodian group has called on people from every immigrant and refugee community to come out and support their rally tomorrow in Tacoma.
This week, two Portlanders were shot and killed by members of the Portland Police Department. For many local residents, this has raised questions on the use of deadly force by police in the city. KABU reporter Ryan Katz spoke with Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch about the incidents and their potential fallout.
We're talking today about a couple of deadly attacks that happened in the Portland area this week. Do you mind recapping them for me?
My understanding is there are two incidents back-to-back. Wednesday and Thursday. On Wednesday, Milwaukee police officers were chasing a suspect who apparently ran a patrol car, and they ended up shooting him. And then on Thursday, the Portland police were trying to find a robbery suspect in the Springwater corridor down by Foster Road. And when they confronted him, they said he was swinging a crowbar at them. And one of the officers fell down while they were trying to disengage and shot and killed the man.
both of these incidences were examples of use of deadly force. When is it permissible for Portland police officers to respond in this way?
Generally speaking, what the law says is that if an officer feels that their life or somebody else's life is in imminent danger, they have the right to use deadly force to protect themselves or the other people. Portland police policy is generally that the officers can't put themselves in a situation where they then, because of what they did, they use deadly force and then say, I felt my life was threatened, because that would be against policy. And officers are not supposed to, use deadly force right away. They're supposed to consider their other options that are available to them so that we can reduce the amount of force that's being used overall. And more specifically, since the Department of Justice came in 2012 and said that the police were using too much force against people with mental illness, regardless of whatever the policy says, because the law says they can do it if they feel like their life was threatened. Officers, with one exception, have never been prosecuted in Portland for the use of deadly force. And that officer still hasn't been prosecuted, he's just in charge. And they very rarely get punished in any way through an administrative investigation.
So you're saying that there aren't that many, incentives for Portland officers to avoid the use of deadly force in those kinds of situations?
In my opinion, yes. I think that what you just said is an accurate way to look at it. On the other hand, we have Officer Ron Frashauer, who shot and killed Aaron Campbell in 2010. Campbell was unarmed, an African-American man, and his hands were up behind his head. And because he wasn't putting his hands in the air, one officer used the less lethal, so-called shotgun on him, and he moved his hand off his head, and then a sniper officer shot and killed him by firing a bullet in his back. Both officers were punished. Both officers have been fighting their punishment. The officer who fired the beanbag gun was given 2 weeks suspension, and he's fighting that, and the officer who killed Aaron Campbell was fired, but he was reinstated by an arbitrator, and then the city's put him on paid administrative leave, and so he's been sitting there off duty basically for a year and a half. It could be in the back of their minds, an officer might think, oh, well, I might end up getting fired for this, but I'll probably end up getting my job back and getting paid for all the time I was wrongfully fired, because that's the way our arbitration system seems to have been over the many years, that the officers always get their jobs back.
So do you think that these two incidents this week indicate a pattern of use of deadly force by the Portland Police Department?
I would hesitate to call anything a pattern with the shooting. They come and go in waves. And so there was a year, or more than a year, where there was no shootings at all by the Portland Police. And then all of a sudden there was one in March. There was one about a month later in April. And now we have another one almost exactly 2 months after that. In June, the proximity of the one that happened on Wednesday in with Milwaukee police and the one that happened yesterday with the Portland police, that is something that we see as a pattern, where when there's an officer-involved shooting, very frequently there's another one very shortly after that, because the officers are on heightened alert and they think that everybody's out to get them. And rather than using all this training they're supposed to have to de-escalate and think of other ways to deal with situations, they resort almost immediately to deadly force because they've seen this other incident happen, so it's fresh in their mind.
So you mentioned the settlement between the DOJ and Portland Police Department. What is the current status of that?
KBOO listeners may remember that in February, 60 community members came out to testify at what was called a fairness hearing in front of Judge Michael Simon, the federal judge who's overseeing that case, and said, we don't think that the agreement the city came to with the Department of Justice is strong enough. It does not go far enough. It doesn't fix the problems that we've seen over the years. And the judge looked at that for about a month, and he said, well, even though I hear what the community's saying, I trust that what the two parties to this lawsuit, the DOJ and the city, have come to is an agreement. That'll work, but I cannot sign off on this thing unless they come back to my courtroom once a year where I can sit down and ask them questions about how it's being implemented. I won't be able to do anything else. I won't be able to change the agreement or force them to do anything. All I can do is ask questions. And the city said, no, we're not going to. So we're basically in a holding pattern.
Does the settlement agreement as it currently stands have some sort of retraining aspect of it? How has the settlement sort of played out in that retraining, and how successful has it been?
The Bureau has been implementing what they interpret the settlement agreement to mean. The settlement agreement does essentially say that the police should train to use less force than is necessarily allowed under the federal laws and under, you know, court cases.
So do you think that any of these latest incidents in March and now this week will have any impact on the settlement or any future use of deadly force by the Portland Police Department?
It's hard to know whether this is going to affect the agreement, whether anybody's scrutinizing them for the tactics that the officers use and whether the officers could have, you know, and in this most recent case, they said that they were trying to disengage, but he tripped and fell. So he supposedly was trying to use some of these techniques to not use so much force, but then when he fell down, my belief is he probably panicked and pulled his gun and shot the person. You know, we know the officers want to go home safe at night. The community members also want to go home safe at night, and we have to find a way for that to happen.
I have been talking with Dan Hanelman from Portland Cop Watch. This is Brian Katz with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy with a high of 67, and Sunday, more of the same. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels up for today are 33 counts per minute in North Portland, 32 counts per minute in Vancouver, Washington. Eugene, Oregon has a count of 27 CPM. Hanford, Washington has a count of 31 CPM. And North Vancouver, British Columbia has a current radiation count of 35 counts per minute. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by Geiger counters. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org. Today in history, Thurgood Marshall became the first black man to be nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court. 4 years later, in 1971, the New York Times published the Pentagon Papers, revealing that during the Vietnam War, the U.S. had secretly engaged in bombing Cambodia and Laos. The quote of the day comes from D.H. Lawrence. He said, "Ethics and equity and the principles of justice do not change with the calendar."
It's 5:22. Time for the daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If you're an upper-class, uber-rich Brit, the price of being blessed with such wealth and social standing is that you're expected to be at least slightly amusing to the general public, offering some combination of doofus, daffy, and scandalous. Crispin Odie does not disappoint. He was born to old money, but most of it was lost by the time he came of age. So Crispin set out with old-fashioned drive and the help of some very wealthy old-school backers to make a new fortune. As a London hedge fund huckster, he has scored big during Europe's ongoing financial crisis by making socially useful investments, such as betting that British banks would collapse. They did. Ordinary Brits suffered, and Crispin became a billionaire. That's what hedge fund geniuses do. Of course, he now lives in a proper British mansion, but Odie is not satisfied to wallow selfishly in the wealth he raked in from his bets on the misfortunes of the masses. Rather, he's boosting the local economy by hiring architects, artisans, construction crews, and designers to build a very special $250,000 house on his estate. In so doing, he's also boosting the spirit of an entire nation caught in an economic slump. Indeed, Crispin has ignited the fiery spirit of populist outrage in merry old England. Why? Because the $250,000 house he has commissioned is a chicken coop. Yes, a full-scale stone structure of about 6,000 square feet designed as a Grecian temple, complete with 24 columns and carved flourishes around the roof, all for chickens. Adding to the merriment, a chicken and egg are carved into one wall with a Latin inscription asking, "Who came first?" This is Jim Hightower saying the answer to that one is easy. Like billionaires everywhere, Crispin always puts himself first. The common people and the common good be damned. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
A food industry giant wants to challenge Vermont's unprecedented decision to label genetically modified food. Vermont's attorney general says they're ready for the fight. A lobbying group, including the Grocery Manufacturers Association, the Snack Food Association, the International Dairy Foods Association, and the National Association of Manufacturers, filed a lawsuit challenging the GMO labeling law. The industry groups say that GMO labeling is a violation of their freedom of speech. They filed a complaint in federal court this week. For more on this story, KBOO's Ryan Katz spoke with Catherine Paul from the Organic Consumers Association.
What was sort of the purpose of the law, and what does it say?
Sure. Well, the purpose of it is to require mandatory labeling of foods that contain genetically modified ingredients. The law also would prohibit companies from using the word natural on any food product that contains genetically modified organisms or ingredients. The purpose of that law is pretty much the same as laws that have been proposed in now close to 30 other states. As consumers become more and more aware of what genetic engineering is and the potential health hazards, there are more concerns about avoiding those foods and requiring companies to let consumers know.
What kinds of foods are we talking about, and what kinds of GMOs are going into them?
The fairly accepted statistic is that the 75 to 85% of all processed foods contain genetically engineered ingredients, usually show up in anything that contains corn or corn syrup or anything that contains soy, anything that contains sugar from beets, things like canola oil. It's widespread. And particularly if you're talking about processed, it's safe to say that close to 80% of all those products contain genetically modified ingredients.
And what kinds of health risks are associated with those?
It's been linked to certain types of cancers, particularly non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Things like the increase in allergies that we've seen, the increase in things like autism, chronic health issues that are related to digestive disorders such as Crohn's disease, and obesity, which is in itself a health problem.
This week, the news came out that a group is filing a lawsuit to preempt the GMO labeling law in Vermont. What group is this, and what interest do they have in the law not passing?
Industry trade groups filed the lawsuit, primarily the Grocery Manufacturers Association. That lobbying group has been fighting, spending millions of dollars in California, Washington State, Vermont, in an effort to prevent these labeling laws. And the reality is that these companies use a lot of cheap ingredients in their food, and they don't want to be forced to make a change.
How many countries around the world have laws that require companies to label GMO products?
I think the latest count, there were 62 countries that have either banned GMOs altogether or require labeling. And the U.S. is the only really developed country, if you want to use that term, that doesn't have labeling laws.
Why do you think that is?
Because groups like the Grocery Manufacturers Association and Monsanto have such deep pockets that they've been able to prevent these laws from passing.
How can consumers push back on the multi-billion dollar food industry that is trying to block this law from passing?
By not buying their products. That's the best way to fight back, to boycott the products. Consumers have to stick to their guns on this. And it's a health issue, it's an environmental issue, it's a states' rights issue, and even the latest polls continue to show that well over 90% of people believe that we have the right to have this information, and we need to continue to demand it.
I have been speaking with Catherine Paul from the Organic Consumers Association. This is Ryan Katz with KBOO News.
Two recent studies show that in the current market, cars may be a better deal than mass transit for lower-income Americans. A new study by the Urban Institute finds that car owners are twice as likely as transit users to find jobs and four times more likely to retain them. That study reaffirms previous research by the Progressive Policy Institute that car ownership plants the seeds of upward mobility. Transportation produces almost 30% of all global warming emissions in the U.S., and 61% of those emissions come from cars and light trucks. There's a stigma attached to cars among urban planners as gas-guzzling polluters. Planners also promote carpooling, as well as daily rental programs like Zipcar, which has caught on in Portland. One author of the Urban Institute study says any serious conversation about poverty must include the issue of automobile access. Wendell Cox, a transportation consultant, argued in the last decade for subsidizing car ownership. He claimed that providing cars to every American transit user would cost $10 billion, compared to the $25 billion spent annually on transit subsidies.
The United Methodist Church divested all its church pensions held in a company that provides services and equipment to Israel's military and prison complex, including settlements and the separation wall. The company in question, G4S, was also recently hired by the City of Portland to provide security guards for City Hall and Union Station. But the company has become the target of a divestment campaign